From the studios of KXAM, welcome to Tell the Truth Faster, hosted by Stuart Altshuler, marriage and family therapist. Stay tuned and learn how you can open your mind and soul to new possibilities in life. Now here's your host, Stuart Altshuler.
Welcome to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist, and this is a show where every week we deal with a variety of mental health issues. I take a more holistic approach in my work, which means finding balance in body, mind, and spirit. And we all know that the truth will set you free, but the question we ask here is, how long are you willing to keep freedom on hold? How long are you willing to keep looking the other way to issues that are going on in your life and choose not to deal with it? Issues that are going on in your community and choose not to deal with it. And there is a lack of freedom that comes when we're in constant fear and constant stress and constant turmoil. Unfortunately, as we see all around us in our society today, and the starting point is feeling a sense of balance within ourselves, to making a commitment to dealing with our own issues within our own environment and healing what needs to be healed so that we could actually move on, be role models to others around us, and be a participant in life at a higher level. So this is a live show. It's a call-in show. And the phone number, if you want to participate once I tell you today's topic, is 480-949-1310. That's in the greater Phoenix area, 480-949-1310. If you're listening via the internet, as I know some of you are, because I get emails from some of you and occasionally a phone call, it's the same number, it's a toll call, but certainly worth calling into the show, 480-949-1310. Today's show is one I've done a couple of times before, but not with the guest I have today, who's actually rather prominent in this field. The title of today's show is Society's Throwaway Kids, which are gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender teens. And this is an issue that affects all of us, whether you realize it or not. The National Mental Health Association states in one of their handouts about bullying in schools alone, they say that while trying to deal with all the challenges of being a teenager, gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender teens additionally have to deal with harassment, threats, and violence directed at them on a daily basis. They hear anti-gay slurs such as homo, faggot, and sissy about 26 times a day or once every 14 minutes. Even more troubling, a study found that 31% of gay youth have been threatened or injured at school in the last year alone. Now, you know, there are some people that will listen to that and say, well, I didn't know. There are some people will listen to that and say, well, they deserve it for who they are and what they're, you know, representing and all that stuff. And unfortunately, that's the attitude that creates the higher level of suicide and attempted suicide, depression, a sense of homelessness, substance abuse, and dropout rates amongst this population, meaning GLBT teenagers. So we know that these kids are having a more difficult time being educated because of the added stresses. Now, if you think what normal teenagers are dealing with, and I use that word normal, I mean teenagers in general, it's a difficult time for every teenager. Think back to your own teenage years, hitting puberty, hitting a higher level of expectations all of a sudden. What are you going to do with your life? Where are you going to go to college, or what are you going to do for a living? All those sort of things. That's something that impacts every teenager. You know, social acceptance or lack of, no matter what the issues are, everybody's concerned with that. You add this other level of sexual orientation and the struggle that these teens go through and the need to hide it that they feel they need to hide, although there are plenty of teens in junior high and high school today that are dealing with this at a much more open, in a much more open way and much sooner than most from my generation, to say the least, have been able to do. In fact, if you listened about a year or two ago, I had a junior high school guidance counselor who came on to talk about a girl that she worked with and her family who came out of the closet at age 13, who knew clearly who she was and what she was. And luckily, this girl had a guidance counselor that was compassionate and understanding and did her homework and helped that family and helped that girl. And you can listen to that show actually on my archives. So, without further ado, I want to get deeper into this issue, talk about the problem, why this problem exists, and what the solutions are. And my guest actually is a tremendous part of the solution. Her name is Teresa DiCrescenzo. She's a licensed clinical social worker. She's the founding executive director of the Gay and Lesbian Adolescent Social Services in the Los Angeles area. And they own and operate 5 licensed group homes for sexual minority youth and HIV-infected teenagers, and places children of all ages in loving foster homes. Terry, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Stuart. I'm happy to be here.
Let's start with your catch as to, number one, why did you get involved in this particular population, and what do you see as the problem we're talking about here today?
Well, my personal involvement began about 35 years ago. So that's a long time, and I've seen a lot of changes in those 35 years. I was working for Los Angeles County as a social worker, working with children and adolescents, and what I found was an entirely separate system within the system, an informal system, for treating these youngsters who were GLBT, and that system was not a very positive approach. That system was the gay kids, the lesbian kids, the bisexual and transgender kids got sent to more restrictive environments. If they were in a facility of some sort, out of home care, and there was some sort of mutual peer play type of sex incident, the gay kid or the lesbian kid would get thrown out and maybe sent to a higher level of facility. Higher level means more restrictions, locked up, and so on. And I just really reached a point in my own career where I thought, I really can't just float along, having a swell career, watching these kids get a separate level of treatment that is inappropriate. So I quit my job and started this agency. In sharp contrast, everything they teach us in social work school, don't put your own money into starting a nonprofit because it won't work. But I just felt it was something I had to do. I really felt compelled to do it. And I take no great measure of pride in the sense that I believe someone would have done it. I just happened to be there, and I happened to be the one who did it. As to the second part of your question, what the problem is, the good news is that things are getting better. Thanks to many organizations, some of which I think you've featured on your show in the past, PFLAG, Parents and Friends of Parents, I guess it's changed the name now, Parents, Families and Friends of Lesbians, Gays, et cetera, and the Trevor Project,
right,
and GLSEN, and so on. So there are many, many more supports for those youngsters, but we still have kids who hear homo, faggot, queer, dyke as if it were one word, homo, faggot, queer, dyke, and as you pointed out, they hear it every few minutes. I remember a youngster who said all he remembered from school was the floor, because he simply put his head down and looked at the floor in the hopes that he could walk by other children without being harassed or attacked or assaulted. So the problem is definitely being attended to a lot better than it was 35 years ago, that's for sure, but it still is a significant problem for these youngsters. You mentioned the school setting and some of the research that some organizations have completed. We know that children in school are abused for 3 reasons: race, weight, and sexual orientation. And it's just that simple. So it's quite a problem. question about.
Well, you know, even I remember back in the 50s and 60s when I was in school, I was an overweight kid, and I remembered the harassment. In fact, it was quite painful, but it was not just because I was fat. I was also called sissy and all these other things.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
at that point, you know, the word gay wasn't in a vocabulary, but
sure.
it did today, like my 17-year-old nephew, although I try and impact him in some way about using it, you know, the word, you know, oh, that's so gay, or you're so gay and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like just, you know, the new way of you know, putting somebody down or making a statement, and yet it's extremely accepted.
Very much so.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes all the way to the earlier years of grammar school when I'm reasonably confident the youngsters really don't have any idea what the word means. Nonetheless,
right.
they say,
mm-hmm.
oh, that's so gay. Oh, you're, what are you, gay? It's just a way of saying, what are you, a jerk?
Right.
And but just because it only means jerk these days, it's still very hurtful to children who hear.
Because I think at a younger age, people are aware of what gay, homosexuality, and all that stuff is because there's so much more in the media about it that even elementary school age kids may have seen an episode of Will and Grace or may have seen other things or may have, you know, there are so many more people out of the closet today than there were 30 years ago or since Stonewall that they may actually have a friend of the family or a brother or sister or somebody who has made a statement. You know, my 17-year-old nephew knew that he had a gay uncle from the time he was like 6 or 7. And so at an early age, I think they're much more aware that there's something about this. They may not understand that it's about sexuality or what sexuality even is, but they know there's something different.
Well, that's right. And that, again, is a mixed blessing because the, you know, the point of your show is about people either choosing to let things go by or making the effort to deal with these issues. And when children see things like, as you say, Will and Grace, which I always like to call gay people as chia pets.
I agree.
My 11-year-old, an 11-year-old client of mine, her mother, who happens to be a lesbian, was speaking about when and how and under what circumstances she should disclose. So I was interviewing the youngster, and the youngster said to me, well, I love gay people. They're the funnest. I love Will and Grace. I love Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. The upside of that is you can say the word gay and people don't gasp or faint. The downside of that is this youngster has not the vaguest idea what it means to be gay.
Mm-hmm.
And to the extent that she does, she thinks it's about pretty clothes and lots of fun. And ironically enough, George Weinberg, who created the concept of homophobia back in 1973 in his book, Society and the Healthy Homosexual, says that one of the reasons that homophobia exists in our society is because people look at some gay people and they see a stereotype of sort of gay boys dancing in the night. And that gay people have nothing more to think about and no more responsibilities than, you know, where to go dancing tonight.
Mm-hmm.
So you see there's a very mixed blessing to have Will and Grace out there helping our 9-year-old nephews and nieces like, put it in quotes, like gay people.
Right. I think that's why so many people are having difficulty with this gay marriage issue and gay adoption or gay parenting. Because all of a sudden it puts GLBT adults in a different light of being responsible, relationship-oriented, parenting-oriented individuals, and that doesn't fit the picture of that most homophobic people want to keep harping on.
Of course, that makes it real, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Now it's no longer Queer Eye running through and foo-foo-nana on somebody's living room couch and making pretty curtains. Now it's about the same issues we all deal with. Where should we live? Where are the best schools for our children, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit more about the type of teenagers that you reach out to. I know that there are a couple of major issues that they're facing. Number one has to do with mental health. Number two has to do with education. Number three has to do with family. And that a lot of the kids that you deal with, you know, are basically considered, in a sense, throwaway kids by communities and societies and even families. You know, once they're out or perceived to be who they are, families may reject them, and communities, it's just not safe for them, they feel, to stay in their communities. The percentage of runaways, teenage runaways out there, is significantly skewed towards GLBT teens. Who are these kids that you're helping?
Well, I think you just described them, the youngsters who, upon disclosure to their families, come to be known as GLBT, and the families become abusive towards children, or simply banish them from their homes, or the children run away because they. I remember a young lesbian who got herself at the age of 15 a part-time job sweeping the floor in a lesbian bar after the bar had closed at 2 a.m. And she got no salary, but she was allowed to sleep in the back storeroom. She felt safer sleeping in the back storeroom of a lesbian bar than she did in her own home. So these children look at the streets as a safer place in their own homes. And since 13 children die every day, let me say that again, 13 children die every day in the streets of America, that says something when the streets look safer than your own home.
Yeah. And definitely safer than their own schools. Now I know that there are many teachers and administrators who wish to stop harassment and anti-gay comments, but very few of them have any specific training which would teach them to intervene effectively, and a lot of them would fear reprisals from administration and other staff members, or maybe even parents. So what do you do for those teachers or guidance counselors, like the guidance counselor I talked to at the opening, who really was an angel when this girl came to her and really was a major support, and in conservative Riverside had the support of her administration. So that's a surprising thing there. But what do you do to actually help the school environment become a safer thing so maybe these kids don't feel like they have to leave?
Well, there are a number of things that we can do, and it does vary from school district to school district. I got a call the other day from an adolescent, and I won't say the name of the school district yet on the air because I haven't confirmed the complete, you know, facts here. Mm-hmm. But the youngster called and asked for help with mentoring, which is one of the things my agency does, is sponsor mentoring programs for GLBT teens and adults. And I said, well, we can talk to you about the possibility of our program, but how about at school? And he said, well, our school does have a mentoring program. And, of course, he named the school, which, as I said, I'm not going to name. And he said that they have a mentoring program, but not for us. And I said, well, can you tell me what you mean by us? And he said, well, I'm gay. And he said they won't give me a mentor, and I asked him to clarify as to whether or not they specifically decline stating overtly they won't give him a mentor because he's gay, and he said absolutely yes. Now something like that would be not only against the regulations, it would be illegal in some school districts and perfectly legal in other school districts, and as you and your readers might have seen in the newspapers recently that another school district in California has actually sued the state of California, which has, as you know, a regulation to protect all children, and they specifically name GLBT children in that piece of legislation from harassment at school. And this youngster wore a T-shirt that said something on the order of God doesn't like homosexuals or some such thing.
Right, that's the San Diego district.
Exactly. Yeah. And so in this instance, the administrator attempted to step in and protect the gay youngster and told this youngster that he would have to either change the shirt or go home. And he said, I don't have to change my shirt and I don't have to go home because God is on my side or whatever. And the school district is supporting this youngster. So the school district is doing several things that I think are kind of awful. One is supporting this youngster in his expression of homophobia. And undermining the administrator who's trying to protect the gay youngsters, giving official credibility to taking that kind of posture against any person or any group of people. I wouldn't be no more pleased if someone went to school, you know, with a sign that said, you know, God hates straights or anything of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
It's simply inappropriate.
I wasn't aware that the school district was actually supporting the kid for wearing that shirt.
The school district has filed a suit. The school board of that district voted to join and sue the state of California, saying that the state of California has no right on a First Amendment basis to stop this youngster from expressing. Now, you know, that's a very slippery slope because now if you can wear a shirt that says that, then why can't you wear a shirt that says God don't like African Americans and God don't like Asian Pacific Islanders,
right,
so on and so on.
Well, okay.
So a lot going on out there.
Yeah, and, you know, we think that because of the Will and Grace and Queer Eye for the Straight Guy that, you know, there are a lot of people out there who have become complacent and actually maybe annoyed that there's so much of it in the media now, that there's too many gay characters on TV. It's enough, even though, you know, they may be, you know, supportive of sexual orientation issues, that they don't get that a lot of these kids on a daily basis are still being impacted in school, outside the school. I mean, attacks, physical, violent attacks on these kids is significantly higher than the general population.
Absolutely. Those districts who track hate crimes and then break them down by race and gender and so on, we find that historically those kinds of crimes and hate crimes in schools and bullying in schools, the GLBT population is always either number one or number two behind or just in front of African Americans. And in recent months, against those of the Muslim faith have or people who are perceived to be Middle Eastern in origin get a lot of that as well. But typically the GLBT kids are somewhere in either first or second place when they track these crimes, because we must remember that school is not a sitcom. School is not Will and Grace.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had too much of them on television of the Chia Pet variety, I think, but I'd like to see the sitcom or the weekly series that has Dad and Dad and their two kids and all of what they go through, and Mom and Mom, or a single lesbian mom. Those are the characters I'm still waiting to see. I haven't seen one yet,
mm-hmm.
unless you count the L Word, where everyone looks as if she's just come from the beauty shop. And that, you know, once again, that's not real life.
Uh-huh.
And I suppose television isn't necessarily meant to be real life. But,
right.
At least some reflection of what we see in the real world would be nice.
Yeah, I agree with that totally. Now, we also know that because of the harassment in school, that kids who are GLBT are more likely to drop out. And, in fact, I have one statistic that 20% of gay students will drop out of school. This is more than three times the national average for heterosexual students. And with that increased, another statistic is approximately 40% of the homeless youth are identified as gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender. So when these kids drop out of school, they're also leaving their community. And that adds to the issue of survival. And survival very often means drug use and prostitution. I'm not saying for all of them, but it's not a difficult jump to make when you're on the street trying to survive, trying to feed yourself, and you're 15, 14, 16 years old. you can't, you're not stable enough to just say, okay, I'm going to go get a job. I'm going to, you know, find a place. You know, it's like a lot of times I'm going to go find someone to take care of me, or I'll deal drugs, or I'm so much in pain. It just feels better just to stay stoned all the time. Are these the kids basically that end up in your organization?
Absolutely. Only last week I was in my office doing some paperwork and some budget work, and the receptionist said a particular youngster was downstairs, and I went downstairs, and here was a 19-year-old girl and her 17-year-old sister, and she told me that she and her 17-year-old sister and their 16-year-old sister, so three girls, all sisters, 16, 17, and 19, were staying in a cheap motel, $58 a night. She earned $50 a day in cash, wiping down cars at a car wash, and had every day to figure out how to get the other $8 for the room, and, of course, some food and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And she told me she was earning that money dancing, and she insisted that she was not prostituting yet. The important word here is yet.
And she was aware enough to use the word yet.
That's right.
Yeah,
she
knew
nothing,
the direction. Yeah.
Yeah. She said, nothing is going to stand between me and taking care of my two sisters, she said. And very mature for a 19-year-old, she said, you know, I want legal custody of them because her father is in prison and her mother's on the streets. They were all abused by the mother's boyfriend. And she just wants out, and she'd rather live in a cheap motel and do whatever she has to do to get enough money to get by. And this is not an unusual story for us. I mean, the unusual part is the three siblings at the same time. But otherwise, this is not an unusual story for us. And the statistics you mentioned about the youngsters on the streets, significant percentages of them being GLBT. When we look at homeless adults on the street, we find two things that are very, very significant. We find a lot of things that are significant, but the two that are germane to our conversation now are that the adults, more than 50% of them, adults homeless, were in the out-of-home care system, the foster care system in this nation, which is broken,
mm-hmm.
badly broken, about 40% of them self-identify as GLBT. So, you know, you start mixing and scrambling those statistics, and then you've got the significant percentage of, I might add, people in penal institutions as well. About 60% of them were in the foster care system. So you have a system that does not work. It certainly is not designed, well-designed to help sexual minority youth, GLBT youth. And you have then the problem of, now sometimes people say, well, that's very sad, it's very touching, but look there, now you've gotten them off the streets and everything is fine. The problem is that for many of these youngsters, by the time they get off the streets, they come off the streets HIV infected, they come off the streets with hepatitis C, which is being referred to in the research communities and the medical communities as the new AIDS, because it too sneaks up on you and lies dormant in your body until it's ready to kill you, mental illness. Who wouldn't be mentally ill, become mentally ill, depressed, anxious, if you didn't know where your next meal was coming from,
mm-hmm.
or if you had to have sex in order to get the next meal, and if this swell guy took you home who was going to, quote, take care of you, when in fact, when he finished with you sexually, you get maybe one night's sleep, and otherwise you're out the door,
mm-hmm.
and you're back on the streets. And you're not out the door with $200 or $300 as a thank you. You're just out the door. So these kids go through horrendous experiences at an age when they should be getting all of the nurturing that every child deserves. And that's kind of my attitude, is that every child deserves a permanent home. Every child. It's not a privilege. It's a right.
Yes. And one other thought that came to me about this is that some of these kids that are out on the streets who are having survival sex, prostitution, things
yeah.
like that, you know, may actually not even be gay or lesbian, but it's the only way that they can survive. So if their sexual orientation, they may be doing something that is really not in line with their orientation, but it's how they survive. So I would think that there are a certain number of kids out there who are heterosexual in orientation, but this is the only thing that they can do, they think, to survive on the streets.
Oh, absolutely. And there's a wonderful book on the subject called For Love or Money. In other words, these youngsters are having sex sometimes under the illusion that they're going to find someone to love them in ways that their own parents didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And others are doing it just for the money because they need that money to survive. So sure, there are lots of non-GLBT kids having same-sex prostitution experiences out of necessity.
Right.
Sure.
Now let's talk about GLASS itself. I want the people who are listening to understand the power of what you've created and your staff has created and what you actually do for these kids. So do you actually go out to the streets? Do you have teams that actually go out there to try and gain the trust or make connections with the kids, or do you wait until they get to you?
No, absolutely. We have GLASS is the oldest and largest GLBT youth-serving organization in the country. We began in February of 1984 with one, a small six-bed licensed group home, which is in February of 1984. We opened. That house was full then, and it's full today. It's never had an empty bed day in the history of the agency. And for that matter, we have a new home opening probably this week. We've got all the licensing things in place. We've got the furniture in place, and so we're just waiting for the green light from the licensing folk. It's another six-bed group home where we do provide children with permanent homes. And the house will hold six children. We already have seven on a waiting list for it. And that will bring our license capacity for the group home programs to 51 children.
How many homes is that?
That is six, seven homes.
Wow.
And it's tremendously cost ineffective. You know, we could do what a lot of agencies do and get one big facility and build, you know, a 55-bed dormitory. But, you know, that's kind of like living in an orphanage.
Mm-hmm.
And so we try very hard to create a family-like environment because we do become family to these children. And they come to us from a variety of sources. One is we do have a street outreach program, and it's got two components. One is called MOHOP, which stands for Mobile Health Outreach Project. And that's a three-room doctor's office on wheels, and it costs us about $1,300 every day it goes out.
Wow.
That's just in van rental fees and sanitary stuff, because we have a doctor on board, we have a nurse practitioner on board, and we actually provide primary health care to the youngsters on the streets. And then we have, it's called ATROP, and it's the Homeless Health Outreach Project, and that's a mental health program for youngsters on the streets. Because you said it yourself, you go out there and try to get their trust, because we can't go out there and say, here we are, you lucky little kids, we're here to take you off the streets, because their attitude is, we don't need to come off the streets, we take care of each other on the streets, and we don't need you.
Mm-hmm.
And when we started the Mobile Health Outreach Project with a $500,000 grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, in 1995, it was based upon needs assessment studies we did with the children on the streets who said, we need to have a mobile health unit. That's what we need.
So you actually went to these kids?
You bet.
What do you need out
you
here?
Bet.
Conscious adults. It's like most people think of kids as not knowing what they need and not knowing how to take care of themselves. But these kids are survivors.
You
but
bet.
They also know exactly what's missing and what they need.
You bet. And in fact, back in those days, people raised challenges to us in terms of, well, you know, there are free clinics. Why are you, you know, doing this instead of that? It's because the youngsters have said, number one, it takes too long on the bus to get to a free clinic. Number two, sometimes when they get there, they feel they're made to wait too long, and people argue, well, you know, they don't exactly have a busy schedule, but it's about respect. And so when they don't feel respected, and then when they get a prescription, they can't always fill it. So, and
I think there's another layer of issue there, that a lot of them may go to these free clinics and the staffs are not necessarily conscious of or trained in a sensitivity to these kids in terms of GLBT issues.
Also true.
So what your organization does is saying, you're the ones we're here to serve. We know who you are, and you told us what you need, and we respect that, so here it is.
Exactly. So we have... seven licensed group homes. We have MOHOP and HOP. We have specialized programs for incest survivors. We have specialized programs for people with substance abuse problems. We have specialized programs for HIV-impacted kids. We have specialized programs for hepatitis C. We have job training programs. And we have just launching a mentoring program, because we've come to realize over these 20 years we've been doing this work that these youngsters need more than we're giving them. I mean, we feel pretty good about what we're giving them, but they need more than we're. They need an older person, male or female, who has their life kind of on track, who can help these youngsters in a sort of life coaching type of way.
Who don't see them as a sexual object.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And to that end, people coming into the program have to take, in addition to being screened through the Child Abuse Index, through the FBI index, through... I mean, they go through a whole lot of screening, and they have to have 30 hours of training, and then they're allowed to mentor, and they have a case manager who checks in with them frequently to see how the mentoring is going. And we have academic
mentors. You really do a thorough screening with these people who say they want to mentor.
You bet.
And
we make it hard enough for them that you have to really mean you want to do it to go through the screening that we put you through.
Mm-hmm.
And you can either be an academic mentor or a life mentor. And it's simply a matter of if your preference is to really just sit with the youngster and help them with homework type of things, we can provide that. Or if you really want to help them with life skills, you have to make the commitment of 4 hours a month, broken into two segments. It's really not a lot of time, but you have to be there every month, not now and again. And the child has to know that their lives are not going to be chaotic anymore. And so if you say you're going to be there, you're going to be there.
Right. It's the same commitment that Big Brothers and Big Sisters and other organizations like that have to make. These are hurt and vulnerable kids, and their history has been adults who have let them down. So, definitely that commitment needs to be demonstrated, and the mentors have to take it seriously and not take it lightly.
Exactly, because the kids take it seriously, and the kids are always ready for one more adult to let them down.
Mm-hmm. In your mission statement that I saw on your website, which if people want more information, I'm telling them they could go to www.glassla.org. That's glassla.org. You mentioned in the mission statement about family reunification. How often does that occur, and how do you go about that?
Well, you know, I'll tell you a little vignette. This past holiday season, I was at a social gathering, and a young man came up to me and said, hi, Terry, do you remember me? And I said, of course I remember you, Calvin. Calvin came up to me. He's now, or this past holiday season, he's 31 years old. We had him at Glass from the time he was 14 years old until the time he was 20 years old. We always made an outreach to his family, because it is my belief and the tenets of the social work profession always hold that the narcissistic wound or I start talking loud like I'm teaching a class. I better try it a little differently. The wound, kind of how you feel about yourself, that you feel like I'm an okay person, not, you know, fabulous, perfect, but I'm an okay person, has to do with having these needs met, these needs usually from a parent. So we always make outreach to parents. And Calvin said, you know, I'm so happy that you kept at me and you kept at my family because we're reconciled now. He said, my mother still doesn't like the fact that I'm gay. She wishes I were not gay, but we're mother and son again, and we have a wonderful relationship, and I really feel happy that we have that relationship. Now, what more can you ask?
Mm-hmm.
And so we have even parents whom we call up and they say, nope, I'm through with that kid. Don't call me. Don't bother me. I mark it for next month, and next month we'll be right back on the phone with you again. We had a youngster graduate from high school a few weeks ago, and he called his mother, and she said, now, why are you calling me up to bother me? And she hung the phone up. Now, that's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
That's heartbreaking. But you know what? I'm going to call her again next month.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're going to keep calling. Not to subject the youngster to further abuse and further heartbreak, but because underneath it all, children want to be connected to their parents, no matter how abusive their parents are. And if we can make the connection without the abuse, then we've done a good job. It doesn't mean the children are going to go back home. Your family reunification doesn't necessarily mean go back home.
Right.
It may mean emancipating, but it will hopefully mean having a decent relationship with your parents.
Or at least start laying the foundation of some communication so that maybe 5 or 10 years down the road there is a different level of connection going on.
Sure,
so,
like Calvin at age 31 telling me that he and his family are reconciled.
I think I told you when we talked a few weeks ago that I had done a show with a guy named Gabriel who at the time, this was about, I think, 2.5 years ago I did the show, and it's on my archives. His name is Gabriel, and he was 24 when I interviewed him, and it was actually one of the most emotionally powerful shows I've done. Even he, in thinking about his experience, you know, he acknowledged GLASS and the Gay and Lesbian Center here in LA as really being his lifeline and lifesaver. So I'm saying that just to kind of reinforce and acknowledge you for the work that you've done. Just like Calvin, this guy really was able to say, this is why I'm alive today.
Boy, that's something, isn't it?
Yeah, and, you know, as he was talking about, you know, I asked him to actually describe what it was like being on the streets, and he talked about the prostitution and the drug use and all this other stuff, and he started talking about the other kids that, you know, they were their own family, and all of a sudden I could feel him over the air welling up,
mm-hmm.
and I said, what's going on right now? What are you feeling? He said, it just dawned on me that most of those kids probably aren't even alive, and here I am able to talk about, you know, my life and maybe help somebody else who, you know, needs it. But it just hit him how, where he finally had come from,
mm-hmm.
and how he could have been one of those kids that didn't survive and didn't make it.
That's right.
It was moving.
That's right.
And touching.
That's very, very moving, and that, of course, is what our work is all about.
Mm-hmm. Now, I also know that you guys have you, like any other nonprofit, you don't survive without donations and without grants and things like that. And I believe your budget is somewhere around $6 million a year.
Oh, it's about nine.
Nine now, okay.
Yeah.
And you have a fundraiser coming up, I know, in October. You want to talk about that for a minute?
Sure,
I know it's at the home
sure.
of Connie Stevens. God bless her.
Yes, God bless her. Her daughter Jolie and Connie are just so wonderful and supportive that they've opened up the home to us, opened up Connie's home to us, and we have the top chefs, Joaquin Spichal of Patina, Jean-Louis Denori of Café Veneto and Locanda Veneto, all the really tip-top restaurants. We're going to have six or seven tasting stations and those little tasties of the foods from a variety of, again, top restaurants, top chefs, paired with some wines from Bruno Heller's Dynamic Imports. They're all organically grown wines. We're going to have a wonderful live auction with an auctioneer, professional auctioneer. We've got a Andy Warhol piece. We've got a David Hockney piece. We've got just wonderful, wonderful items. And you know, it's a heck of a nice afternoon's outing for $100.
Mm-hmm.
For those people who are a little financially better off and want to come to the VIP party and meet a number of celebrities and elected officials, we will be welcoming them inside Connie's home. The rest of the event's a garden party in the afternoon inside Connie's home for $500.
Mm-hmm.
So it's for a good cause, and it's completely tax-deductible, and anybody who wants to either come through the website or just give us a call at 310-358-8727.
Say it again.
310-358-8727, and we would love to hear from people who might want to send a check along and come out and spend a nice summer afternoon up in the Beverly Hills Hills.
Uh-huh. Now also, I'll say again your website, www.glassla.org. That's glassla.org. And so people who aren't in the LA area who still want to donate, they could actually go onto your website to offer donations on via credit cards.
You bet. We'd pay credit cards and checks and people who are local to the LA area or to the Oakland area, Oakland, California, where we have one of our offices and group homes. People who have good. I don't like my kids to have anything but good stuff, but some good quality furniture that's a little bit not suitable anymore for your own home. Anything high end clothing these youngsters need. Supposed to go on job interviews, so we are open to taking any kind of donations that people have.
You actually responded to one of the final questions I had for you. This is something that takes place. I mean, Glass is established here in LA and Southern California. Other than Oakland, are there other Glass organizations, or do you know of other cities that have similar programs that may have been inspired by your work?
Well, as Glass existed for 15 years before we finally got a call from the Boston Home for Little Wanderers. And,
is that what it's called?
That's what it's called.
It's
a 140-year-old adoption agency, and they have never updated the name, and that's what it was called, the New England Home for Little Wanderers.
Wow.
And they finally opened a small facility for GLBT youngsters. They came out and visited us for almost a year. They did a fine job of really, insofar as appropriate to their geography and their needs, replicating our program. And I'm hoping that they may have only been the second, but that soon, if not by now, there will be thirds and fourths and so on. And we've always told people that we're happy to come to wherever people are that need either the training to open such a program in their community, or if they have a piece of property they'd like to donate, we'd be happy to go ahead and open up in their community. Wherever the need is, we are certainly willing to be helpful.
Are you aware of other cities that have similar programs that do this kind of outwork to adolescents?
Not to this population, except for the Boston facility.
Wow. So in this entire country, we're talking about Oakland, Boston, and the L.A. area.
As far as I know, well, and of course, Green Chimneys in New York, Gary Mallon's fine program, while it's not specific to GLBT youth, is very GLBT friendly.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Gary and I co-wrote a small book that the Child Welfare League published on the social service system's need to response to the needs of transgender youth.
Plus, we know that in New York and Los Angeles in particular, there are high schools that actually provide a safer environment specific to GLBT students.
That's true. The Harvey Milk
School.
That's the flagship. That's the first one. It opened the same year that Glass opened, 1984.
The Harvey Milk School's been open that long?
Uh-huh. Sure has been.
Wow. So actually then what was in the news in the last couple of years was then a new facility that they moved
to. Right. They gave, New York gave them a big facility, a bigger facility than the one they had, and gave them some more autonomy in terms of their status within the school district. I don't know quite the politics of the New York school system. But,
We have only a couple of minutes, Terry. Is there anything that you want to make sure you get across before we close today's show?
Well, you know, the theme of your show, deal with these issues. You know, cliche, love your children. They're your children, whether they're gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, celibate, asexual. They're your kids. Love your kids. I don't think I can think of anything
else. That is the perfect statement, and you're right. Tell the Truth Faster is about just that, you know, being honest, teaching your kids to honestly be who they are in the world and not have to live in a space of fear and terror of being found out, and to support even your community's kids that are needed, even if you don't have kids yourself,
exactly.
That there is a need for a consciousness so that school administrators feel your support and school boards feel your support and politicians feel your support. So it's one thing to think it. It's another thing to take action and stand up for, you know, kids who really – although they're a lot more empowered today for a lot of them.
They're still the least among us.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And they need to know there are advocates within their community who may not even know them, but are willing to stand up and say, you're welcome here.
Yeah.
So, Terry, I really want to thank you for taking time out of your Saturday to talk about your program, and I really want to commend you for the work that you've been doing for so long, and I know the level of your own personal commitment to this, and it's admirable and an inspiration, I think, to a lot of other people.
Thank you, Stuart, and thank you for having me.
Well, it's been my pleasure, and I will see you at the fundraiser.
All right, I look forward.
Okay, so for all those of you who are listening out there, if you want to reach Terry, if you have some questions, or like I said, you want to donate to GLASS, you can go to their website. That's www.glassla.org, GLASSLA.org. If you want somebody to listen to the show or missed part of it, in about a week or two, it'll be on the archives on my website. That's tellthetruthfaster.com. And I have every show archived on that site for the last 3 years. So you could listen to other shows I've done, like with the Trevor Project, the show with Gabriel from a couple of years ago, and a variety of other issues that aren't even GLBT related. So please feel free, if you have some comments you want to make to me, you can email me via that website also, and I always appreciate your comments and suggestions and even criticisms. I can handle it. So this is Stuart Altshuler and Tell the Truth Faster. Wishing all of you a great weekend, and thanks for listening in. Tell your friends about the show, and tune in again next week. Thanks for listening. That I heard of one.